Welcome to the PreparedX Podcast, your complete source for crisis, emergency, business continuity, and security preparedness interviews, news, and much more. Now, your host, he creates chaos for a living, Rob Burton.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 24 of the PreparedX podcast. In this podcast, I interview Dan Gortz, who is a security systems senior manager at SecureWorks. I've known Dan for probably about a year now, and I've heard him speak a number of times on cybersecurity-related or at cybersecurity-related events, and very well-spoken and highly regarded within the industry. In this interview, we got talking about the importance of cyber preparedness as it relates to corporations. We covered a number of higher level cybersecurity related topics, including threat actors, insider threats, common gaps based on forensics and analyses, some of Dan's own experience from his career, as well as the importance of exercising. And Dan's insight into this subject is really first class. I think you'll really enjoy this one. It's really important information. You know, Dan has firsthand experience in the field of cybersecurity. So, you know, this is a very good interview, and I think you're really going to enjoy this one. Anyway, here's the interview. Good morning, Dan. How are you doing today?
Hi, good morning, Rob. I'm very well. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Just before we get going, Dan, just for our audience, podcast audience, could you spend a couple of minutes just talking about who you are and what you do in terms of your career, where you've come from, and what you're doing today?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be happy to. So I'm a senior incident response manager for SecureWorks. We're recently independent of Dell, so your listeners might know us as Dell SecureWorks. I've been here almost exactly 6 years, actually. Next week will be 6 years. And I manage about half of our U.S. incident response consultants. I was the interim manager for our EMEA IR consulting as well. And we help clients prepare for and respond to all different types of cybersecurity issues. Prior to this role, I was a contributing member of the team. I was an actual on the ground forensics consultant. And prior to that, I was with a U.S. defense contractor. My undergrad's in network security. I taught network security for a couple of years as well. And the team I'm directly responsible for today does about 200 incidents a year. So a little bit about where I'm coming from.
Very good. Very good. Thank you for that. And so, just a couple of questions here to get us going for this this podcast discussion. In your experience, what's the single biggest cybersecurity challenge that organizations face currently? I know that the landscape's always changing, but you know, currently, what are you seeing in terms of the single biggest challenge?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So obviously, every organization is different, right? But I do see some trends. Although they might not be the most glamorous vectors, the biggest problem I see our customers dealing with currently is still phishing and social engineering, typically against employees, right? And it's really the preferred infiltration vector for many threat actors, both criminal threat actors and targeted. It's like I said, it's not always the most glamorous way in, right? But it's very effective. There's a low barrier to entry. Threat actors can very easily send hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of phishing emails, and they only really need to get a fraction of a percent back to gain access into an environment. So its effectiveness combined with the fact that you're trying to train and assist humans makes it a complex problem to solve.
Sure, sure. I think that leads in. That's a good one to lead into the next question in terms of threat actors. Could you talk for a few moments about some of the external threat actor groups? You know, those groups, be it a state nation, be it some kind of other group that that are active at the moment. Who are those groups, and what are some of their MOs?
Sure. Happy to do that. So we talk about threat actors as typically either criminal or targeted. And the difference is really what motivates them. So obviously they're doing this for any threat group is doing this for some type of gain, right? Criminal threat actors are typically directly monetary. They're doing things like stealing identities, stealing credit card information. We've even seen ransomware used by some of these groups. The goal is to monetize the hack as fast as possible. And your more targeted threat groups are where we talk about nation state cyber espionage. There's more of a value in intellectual property or the target itself having a strategic value as opposed to directly monetizing those attacks. Right? So that's kind of the landscape, the two big groups we deal with.
Right.
For you is I went and pulled one of our threat advisories, one of our public threat advisories. We have many, many more. We track all sorts of different threat groups. But this is one that's already public. It's out there. We can talk about it. And we name our threat groups. We code our threat groups. So this is TG threat group 4127. They traditionally target government, military, and international NGOs, non-government organizations.
Yep.
We have, we have moderate confidence this group is likely Russian in origin. Moderate confidence for your audience means it's credibly sourced and plausible, but not of sufficient quality to state that definitively. So moderate confidence, this is Russian. The group's been observed repeatedly using spear phishing of Google account users. So the domain we observe is accounts-google.com. And one of the tactics we see is them use Bitly, the domain shortening service, to obfuscate that URL. Recipients that click the link are presented with a fake Google login page. The login page is pre-populated with the target's email address, which is kind of the bit that makes it spear phishing. And the targets are heavily skewed towards Russian origin, but do include U.S. and Western targets, including Russian subject matter experts, individuals or groups that are portraying Russia negatively, defense and government organizations, government supply chain organizations, former government or military personnel, and individuals involved with U.S. politics. So take that one how you will.
Right.
So a good example of a targeted threat group, right? It's they're interested in the strategic value of the targets, using what many people think of as a very simple infiltration method, right? The phishing to further their agenda. So I think that's a good example to kind of combine what we've talked about thus far.
That's great. Well, that's a great great example. I think we've leading into kind of the next aspect of how information is either taken from the external source or from an internal issue, and the insider threat always pops up. It's in the news again. Actually, today I read an article about the NSA contractor that was charged with stealing classified material. There's one article today, and it might be the New York Times that talks about that this individual, former intelligence contractor, stole equivalent to 500 million pages of government documents over two decades. And a lot more information, coming out as the court case gets underway. And so, you know, if you could, you know, could talk for a few moments about, you know, the importance of organizations understanding their exposure to the insider threat and what they can do to reduce their chances of becoming a victim of such events.
Absolutely. So insider threat's definitely something you want to be aware of. To be perfectly honest, it's not the most common vector, right? It's not the most common threat that's out there. But when clients do encounter it, it can be really difficult to deal with. So resilience against this type of attack is really best achieved through proper defense in depth strategy. Some things that can help you with insider threats are your security basics. So role-based access controls, right? As well as a least privileged access model. We've got to have that baseline of understanding who should be accessing what, when, and how. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to identify the anomalies. So proper role-based access, least privileged model, and the next step really is authoritative log data. And I think we're going to talk about this a little bit later in the podcast, but logging, you know, things like log on, log off events, DNS queries, and having a safe and trusted authoritative source for those logs becomes very important. Frequently, being able to search those or export them becomes an issue as well. SIMs are great technology, but they're designed to get information in, not necessarily out. And when, you know, you talk about an example like yours where data was moving around for many years, that can be an enormous volume of log data that you're trying to search through. So being able to get that out into a heavier platform becomes important. I think the one last thing, Rob, I think the last thing I'd add is a DLP type solution. I know a lot of people jump to DLP when you talk about tracking data movements and insider threats. Really good. You know, it's a really good technology to have in place, and it will help you reconstruct some of those data movements. Mm-hmm. My big warning with DLP is don't count on it to prevent an incident. You know, I've seen clients do that frequently. I've never worked an incident where DLP has prevented, you know, the data loss. But having it does certainly help us reconstruct what happened.
Okay, that's good information. And I guess, you know, part of that leads into, you know, this next question here with regards to your current role at SecureWorks and part of the services that you provide there is that investigation piece, the analyzing how the organization was breached. And, you know, there's probably a lot of time spent either during and or after the breach is taking place. So based on your experience, can you just talk, I know in general terms without mentioning, you know, any names of any, you know, specific details, but, you know, what are some of the more common gaps that that you find and that, you know, other organizations find truthfully in terms of, you know, what you find when you go through that investigation piece?
Sure, absolutely. So logging is the biggest one, and, you know, we touched on that already, but logging really is the biggest gap that we see. A lot of organizations are set up, they set up their logging infrastructure with IT and system uptime in mind. You know, they're worried about things like account lockups and firewall drop connections and volumes of data crossing the network, various error logs to figure out when things go wrong, what happened. They're important. Don't get me wrong. Those are all important things to be logging and watching for if you're operating a network. But they're incomplete when you talk about incident investigations. So, quick example: we see, you know, if we're doing an investigation, we see a user account being leveraged by a threat actor, right? Something we would call living off the land. Legitimate privileged user account that the threat actor has gotten access to. They've gotten a password for the two-factor for, and they're using that to move around the network. One of our first questions and one of the organization's first questions is going to be, where did they go? What did they do? What did they access? That becomes difficult or impossible to answer without complete and accurate Active Directory logon, logoff events, right, including RDP.
Right.
So failed logins are great if you want to answer what couldn't they get into, what did they lock themselves out of?
Yeah.
In the middle of an incident, that's not the question you're trying to answer, right? It's where did they go, what did they do? Another example would be widespread malware outbreaks. They still happen. Despite all our advances there, even some sophisticated organizations have widespread worm type outbreaks when a zero day comes out. And usually the quickest way to identify those endpoints calling out to command control is going to be DNS logs, what DNS queries are the endpoints making. And that's something that's infrequently retained by many organizations as logs of DNS queries. So just one more example of how logging the correct data for response is not always the same as logging it for operating your networks.
Right. Part of this is, the protection and the day-to-day, maintenance of, the infrastructure, the IT infrastructure involves third parties, vendors. Some of those vendors are more critical than others. So when preparing for cyber-related attacks, why should organizations include those critical vendors? We worked with one organization where vendors had vendors, and so the chain of vendors went down 8 deep, and so the actual organization didn't know, beyond 2 or 3 vendors, how deep these other vendors went in terms of making sure that those vendors were protected and had the necessary, security in place. So, in terms of vendors, can you just talk for a few minutes about how important that is?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think you answered part of your own question right there in that you called them. You call them critical vendors, right? So if they're that critical, then they should be accounted for in your security and response planning, right? If the vendor is likely to be involved with an incident in any way, you should include them in your planning and training and testing. And a couple of situations that we see as far as vendors go. The easiest one is probably a vendor that provides direct support into your environment. They have remote access for some reason, or you're shipping data off to them for daily operations of your systems or networks or what have you. That vendor is going to become critical in identifying incidents, and they're likely to be critical in responding to those incidents if they're the ones using the systems every day. Even if you have access, they're likely to be more effective and efficient at making containment changes than you are. So some things to consider, your SLAs with that vendor and the role of response at a time about, should I have an incident that what are my responsibilities internally, Mr. Vendor? What can you do for me as part of that situation? What are the SLAs? Is that best effort because response is not defined in the service? What are your obligations to spin up additional resources to help me in a crisis? What access do I have to data, right? So you might bring in an outside IR firm or something to that effect. What access do those investigators have to data that resides with the vendor? Logs or forensic images of virtual machines or software as a service logs. All of that can play a big role in the investigation. And the degree to which you have any right to look at it should be defined in your vendor agreement. So that's one, right? The vendor has a direct impact on your environment, direct control of your environment.
Right.
You may have other vendors that are no less critical, but have a less of a direct connection, right? Outsourced payroll is a big one. You know, around tax time, every year we get calls from companies saying false tax return filed for employees or identity theft and that sort of thing. It's really difficult to prove that data breach did not come from the company's network, in that it may have been external to the company's network.
Right.
So what's your vendor's obligation if they have a breach or if you suspect they've had a breach? How far do they have to go investigating that? And do they even need to tell you anything, right? I've seen outsourced payroll vendors say, yeah, you know, complaint heard. We don't have a breach. Have a good day.
Right.
With no more information than that. And it doesn't give your employees a warm and fuzzy when they're dealing with an identity theft situation. Right?
The talk for a few minutes, if you could, about the incident management team. We occasionally will come across, when we conduct these cybersecurity exercises where, beyond the IT team, beyond the security guys, beyond the ones that are, managing the information, what are some of the key roles that you see that are required to make up that incident management team? Because we often will go in and there'll be some, key characters from the organization, key departments that may be missing. And very quickly you realize that, those players, should be involved, maybe early on or maybe at some point, during the event as it starts to unfold. So in your experience, what are some of those key roles that make up the incident management team?
Yeah, that's an awesome question. So we write hundreds of response plans every year for clients, and roles and responsibilities is one of the first things we talk about. And we see two big mistakes, either not including enough of the organization or including too much all the time. It's common for an organization to sit down and say, okay, I've read NIST, I've read ISO, I'm going to write my response plan, and, all of these different crazy things could happen, so everyone needs to be involved when we declare an incident. And that really can hinder you from declaring an incident, right? Because you may not want to go to your CIO or your external legal counsel for the thing that's happening. Not including enough people has a similar effect, right? You might have a really bad incident going on, you declare an incident, but if the individuals you need are not deputized or expected to be brought into that, you may not make progress in your investigation. So when we write plans and we talk about roles and responsibilities, we generally talk about four different components of the team. And I'll give you a quick overview of them here. The first is your CERT leadership team.
Right.
This is going to be your plan owner, your security program owner. These are the people responsible for making sure that you have a response plan in place, that it stays up to date, that it stays tested, that it stays functional for the organization. They're also likely involved in the vast majority of incidents that occur. But the leadership team, as we define it here, really is the group responsible for maintaining the security program. That's usually your director of security, senior manager of security, maybe a senior VP in smaller organizations. It could be a CISO. That's your owner of the security program, whoever those individuals may be. Next, we have our core team, and this is usually your security department, right? Assuming you have one. These are your analysts, your forensic analysts, your security guys, or in smaller organizations might be your IT/security team, right? You might have individuals on IT that also perform You know, they manage the antivirus, they manage your security devices, your IPS, IDS. Your core team is likely to be involved in any incident that you have.
Yep.
So this is your core cert team. From there, we talk about the extended team. And extended team members can be engaged depending on the severity and scope of an incident. So this might be different business unit owners, different data or system owners within the company. It might be IT. It might be your help desk or the IT personnel that can go out and re-image boxes for you if you need that. Your executive leadership comes into play here at the extended team as well.
Yep.
Not every incident that you have is going to warrant a board meeting, right?
Right.
But at a certain severity, it will. So because of the if-then nature of that relationship, the executive board is an extended team here. And lastly, we talk about the external teams, right? You may have a retainer with an investigation organization like SecureWorks. You may have IR or forensic consultants that come in. You may have a PFI firm that comes in if it's credit card related. Your cyber insurance provider is here as an extended team member. External counsel, public relations firms.
Right.
These are groups external to the company that you can bring in the event of an incident.
Sure.
So, key roles and how we divide them up.
That's great. That's really important information, and I think the audience will find that beneficial. The final question I have for you here, Dan, is about the importance of exercising. You know, simulating cyber attacks is an important part of preparing the team for an actual event. And so if you could talk for a few moments about exercising. I know you've had some experience with these services. And what are some of the main benefits from conducting cybersecurity exercises?
Absolutely. So these are some of my favorite engagements to lead. Even as a manager running the team, I'll take some simulations or exercises occasionally and lead them because I personally think they're fun to engage in. Mostly because data is not really going out the door, right? And we get to talk about a lot of what and use some good technologies without a real impact. But let's use an analogy here, if that's all right with you, Rob. So imagine you're back in high school for a second, if you would. I don't know if that was a good or a bad time for you, but we're back in high school.
Right.
You want your driver's license. So the way you decide you're going to go about getting your driver's license is you're going to write a book about driving, and then you're going to study it. So you take everything you know and you've gleaned about the go-karts that you've had and the bicycles that you've had, and you write yourself a manual on how to use the gas and the brake and the clutch and the turn signals and reversing and what to do at stoplights. And you write yourself this manual on everything you think you need to know when you drive. You might even Google safe driving habits, and you include some of those in your manual. Now you study that manual. You're really excited. You spend a weekend, you spend a week, maybe even spend a month studying that manual. But things get busy. You have school and you have other commitments, and it's a year before you get a chance to actually sign up and take your test. So you head over to the DMV and you go sit behind the wheel for the first time, having studied that manual that you built a year ago. How do you think that driver's test is going to go?
Yeah.
You know, it sounds silly, right? But this is
it's a good analogy,
precisely
for sure.
What we see a lot of organizations do. They go out and they read some standards and they Google around, and there's a lot of good information out there. But most security professionals do not go through hundreds of breaches in their career, right? They might go through one or two really big ones, depending whether they work in a large organization or a small one. So really getting outside expertise to help you write an actionable plan, and then using outside expertise to exercise and simulate that plan so you can find gaps and improve and socialize that plan and be used to executing it. Those are the top two things you can do to reduce the impact and cost of a data breach.
Right.
you know, you're identifying gaps and inconsistencies in your plan and in training. It gives you actionable items to show progress in your resilience against the cyber incident as you report to senior leadership and executives. You know, it'll keep security front of mind for your staff. And when the worst does occur, you won't be sitting behind that wheel with a self-made manual and no test, right?
Right, right. Yeah, that is excellent information. I think, we see the similar kind of challenges for organizations that, think it's fine to have that plan on the shelf. I think it's fine to, maybe get together just to have a discussion around it. But actually, walking through the steps and putting all the various details together on how things may play out and how we would respond to those various events in a much more realistic environment, it doesn't happen as often as it should. But I think once organizations go through that a number of times, they get used to those exercises, and then, like you said, once they're ready for their day one or hour one or minute one, they're organized at least, or they've got a plan in place and they've practiced it, and they've it's second nature to them to start to respond in a coordinated manner. So that's really good information. I appreciate all of your responses today to the questions, and very informative, and I want to thank you for that, Dan.
Well, thanks very much for having me. I'm glad to share and help any way I can. This is, as you know, organizations deal with security incidents all the time. You always hope it's not you, but you're going to have something come up at some point, and preparing for that's important. So yes. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, no problem. And just for our listeners, if they would like to get a hold of you to discuss any potential issues with you or contact you for your services, how might they get a hold of you?
Absolutely. For SecureWorks proper, you can find all sorts of information on our managed services and consulting services at SecureWorks.com. And if it's incident response specific, you're currently experiencing a breach, you think you might be experiencing a breach, there is a form on the website, or you can call our hotline directly, and that's 877-884-1110 in the U.S. As far as me personally, Rob, I'll give you some information.
Sure.
You're welcome to post along with show notes, and if your listeners have any questions or want to connect with me, they're welcome to do that on LinkedIn or otherwise.
Okay, that's very good. Okay, we'll make sure we put the show notes together. But again, thanks for your time again today, Dan, and look forward to talking to you again soon.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. That's it for episode 24 of the PreparedX podcast. I think you've probably enjoyed this episode. I know I did. Sat here listening to Dan talk about cybersecurity. What we'd like to do is if you can share this podcast and also rate us on iTunes. If you could do that, we would really appreciate that. I also would like you to check out our recent blogs via preparedx.com. And if you haven't already, please sign up for our bi-monthly newsletter via the link we will provide in the show notes. So please sign up for our newsletter. Some great information we send out on a bi-monthly basis. Until next time, have a safe and productive day. Bye for now.